Hey, scaredy cats, it's Christmas time and we're about to head to Kingston Falls to spend time with family, friends, and furry little creatures. So stock up on some bathroom buddies. I hear they're fantastic stocking stuffers. We're going to make some gingerbread people, get a Christmas tree from a very young Corey Feldman, and watch a late night screening of Snow White and the Seven Dwarves. Just a word of warning though, Kingston Falls may not be as idyllic as it first appears. It's time to get festive, so grab your eggnog or whatever your favorite festive beverage is. Turn down the lights as we chat about the 1984 smash Gremlins.
Steven Spielberg presents Gremlins. Billy Pelser has a nice home.
Billy, is that you?
Yeah, Mom, it's me.
A nice job. A nice girl.
If you're not doing anything this Thursday night, maybe you'd like to go out on a date with me.
I'd love to.
And loving parents who are about to give him...
You're going to like this. No, don't shake it. We're going to have to open it now. We'll wait till Christmas.
The most unusual gift he ever got.
What is it?
It's your new pet.
Come on, Barney, be a good dog. My dad gave it to me.
But there are a few things to keep in mind. If you expose it to the light, you may hurt it. If you get it wet, it will multiply.
All that from water? They got wet?
Plain water.
And most important, no matter how much they beg, never, never let them eat after midnight. Because when they do, they change.
Rafe.
They become clever. Mischievous.
What's going on here?
And dangerous.
Gremlins, huh? Little monsters.
Right.
Hundreds of them.
Well, I don't know, maybe thousands.
I'm with you, too. Billy, what are these things? Where do they come from?
Look, I know it sounds crazy, I know. But in a few hours, you're gonna have a major disaster on your hands.
Gremlins, directed by Joe Dante. They'll be expecting you.
I'm your host, Sherry. This is your friendly reminder that, as always, there will be loads of spoilers. If you haven't seen the movie, please go and watch it. It is absolutely a holiday classic. Otherwise, proceed at your own risk. I mean, the movie is also like almost 40 years old. So
yeah, it's like a year older than me.
So joining us today are Enola, Hub, and Steve. Hey, folks, how are you?
Hello. So good.
Not bad. Thanks. How are you?
I'm excellent, thank you. Thanks for coming on to talk about Gremlins. Why don't you take a second before we start talking about the movie to introduce yourselves. Tell us a little bit about who you are, what you do, that sort of thing.
Sure, I'll start. My name is Hub, and I am the host of Video of the Damned. I do this horror and cult favorite and pop culture review show on YouTube. And I just talk about the movies that I love and hate in the horror genre, and also kind of cover live events and anything in the news related to horror movies coming out. I've been a writer and a fan for several years. I've been in a couple movies myself. I acted opposite a young Bria Grant who went on to do like Halloween 2 and a bunch of stuff. And I got to play a poet terrorist named Bo in a rarely seen Jodorowsky-esque horror called Well of the Beast. It didn't have gremlins in it, but it had a huge-ass scorpion.
I love that. You don't hear of too many poet terrorists.
Yeah, I I feel like it was kind of a niche genre. Maybe that's why not tons of people saw it, but.
Enola, do you want to go next since you're also new to the podcast?
I'm Enola or EL King. You'll see me out there on Twitter a lot and on Slayaway. Our website's slayawaywithus.com. And I'm the editor-in-chief there and one of the writers. And I also host the podcast along with a couple other podcast projects that are in the works for however long. In the works for. But I love talking about horror. I'm a huge fan ever since I was 5 years old. So And I think I'll tell you more about the film that got me into it in a little bit.
You will. I'm excited to hear all about it. All right, Steve, your turn.
I'm Steve. I am the co-host of the Drunkter Who podcast, where I'm watching Doctor Who for the first time with a friend who's a big fan, and we talk about it and drink a couple beers. I've been on Scaredy Cats. This is the third time we talked about The Witch and Creepshow before, so I'm looking forward to, you know, actually staying right around the Creepshow era with Gremlins.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Excellent. Well, thank you everyone for coming on. So as listeners know, when we have new guests on to Scaredy Cats, we'd like to ask you the Scaredy Cat Five. So these are just kind of five questions about your tastes in horror, what got you into horror, that sort of thing. All right. So what's your favorite subgenre of horror?
So my favorite subgenre of horror is what I call This Town is Garbage and We Are Worse. So films like Frankenhooker, Basket Case, really anything by Frank Henlotter. Street Trash is a great one. If you get a chance to track that down, it's beautiful cinematography and then just like the grossest characters and kills and gore you've ever seen. Slime City. You know, a lot of these are like New York based, but there is a newer one in this genre called All Jacked Up and Full of Worms, and it takes place in Chicago, and it's about psychos and perverts who get high off of snorting worms. And you know, the city is garbage and we are worse, but there's also a heart of gold there in the center.
Wow. I think the only one of those movies that I've seen is Basket Case.
Which, you know, I mean, there's no real heroes in that movie. Everybody is a true. Little bit tainted. So that's what makes those movies great.
I think the basket is the hero in that movie.
it really holds the whole thing together.
And as someone who lives in Chicago, I am adding All Jacked Up and Full of Worms to my list right now.
Yeah, you know, so it's not to get your advertisement-esque here, but Screambox is where it is exclusive.
Oh, and, Screambox, okay.
They are doing that whole 99-cent for 3 months deal right now, so it's a good excuse. That and Terrifier 2, which I kind of also think fits the genre, because Damien Loney sure does like a dirty alley in his movies, not only in Terrifier, Terrifier 2, but he did Frankenstein versus the Mummy, which I think you would hear that title and you'd expect like an old like Universal movie, but no, it was a Damien Leone joint from like 2015 or something like that. It's very grimy.
All right, Enola, what's your favorite subgenre of horror?
I don't think I have specific favorites when it comes to subgenres. I will have a mood and sort of lean towards different ones at different periods of time. Right now, I guess I'm leaning towards folk horror.
Oh, nice.
There's been a lot of interesting things happening. And then other stuff that's just like, I don't even think it has a genre, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I think when I watched Barbarian, I'm like, I don't know where this fits.
Very
but
true.
Like, and I like it. It's like, I'm super surprised because either it's blending a lot of different subgenres together or it's creating something new. So that's where I'm at right now.
You know, I think that Barbarian has a real like, you know, I was joking about the city, you know, is garbage kind of thing. But mm-hmm. I do think that movie, I think Detroit and the
critique Detroit. Of
like White Flight and of Police in Action. And really of just like men being able to be bad men without much, you know, without having to really answer for it. I think right. like that all kind of factors into to the state of and the plight of Detroit over the years. And I really hope I'm not spoiling anything for anybody who hasn't seen the movie. I think you can still go into it without knowing that, without, you know, being spoiled on what actually happens and how you see that play out. But
yeah, for sure. That's a really good point. I think it could fit into your favorite subgenre, I feel like, for sure. Sometimes you have to make up your own subgenres. I like it.
Yeah. And I would say most recently, some of the films that I had seen were coming out of some festivals. One was Mother May I, which stars Holland Rodan and Kyle Gallagher. So it's not out yet. It's not released, but it was just a really mind-bendy kind of slow burn situation that I'm really loving anything also that's like mental health and horror. So
nice. Did you like Smile?
Yeah, I liked Smile. I took my mother. My mother doesn't like horror films. I dragged her to it and she liked it.
Oh, wow. Well, that's good. That's good. All right.
She liked it more than Don't Worry, Darling. So.
Have any of you tracked down that Laura Hasn't Slept, the short that they base Smile on? I know it's like just fresh on YouTube.
I have seen it. Not. I'm going to have to take a look at that.
Yeah, same.
Yeah, Barbarian and Smile are two of my blind spots. So I will be catching up with those over the holidays.
Yeah, luckily, I appreciate how quickly things come to VOD.
Yeah.
Oh, that yes. Is,
I think the only positive that came out, I hate to say there's a positive that came out of the pandemic, and that it's movies faster. Mm-hmm. But
and those two specifically are like, I mean, not only are they 2022 essentials, but I think they were both really key in pushing the horror genre more to the mainstream and more to the forefront. And I know that sometimes some of us might like to kind of keep all this to ourselves and be like, hey, I was in before, it was cool. But like, you know, the more money stuff like that makes, the more money that just kind of gets thrown around on the genre in general. And that just means, you know, more creators getting deals to make stuff.
I mean, even Terrifier 2, just knocking the box office out of the park.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And Leone just signed to an agency finally after being unrepresented for years. And so now he's just going to be armed and dangerous now with that behind him.
Yeah, I still feel like I'm catching up to the 2019 releases. So there's just so
much. I need to know what Steve's watching so that I can join whatever watch party it is and kind of take a dive back into 3 years ago when that was before I was doing film criticism and all kinds of stuff. So there's a lot of opportunity for me there, Steve. The door's open.
When we were young and innocent back in 2018.
I don't remember what year it came out, but the last non-Gremlins movie I watched was Santa Jaws. So that was that was an experience.
That's a great one. All right. What is your favorite horror movie?
So I'll start with this one. I for years have been saying Behind the Mask, The Rise of Leslie Vernon.
Oh, excellent choice.
I'm really still partial to it. There's a lot of stuff that came out this year and last couple of years that's starting to kind of creep up the list, but I'm kind of holding firm to Leslie Vernon for now. I just rewatched it over kind of the Halloween season, and this time there were some emotional beats I hadn't noticed before. I think I wasn't mature enough really to understand that there was kind of a romantic undertone between two of the characters, which I won't spoil here, but it got me a little verklempt watching it this time.
Anola, what about you? What's your favorite?
That it's ever changing because it's hard for me to stay on one thing.
That's fair.
Sharing them. But I have kind of just a really growing list of things that I grew up on, right? So like my first horror film was Stephen King's Silver Bullet, and that got me into like creature features from the time I was five. And it was something that I shared with my grandmother. And I feel like I share a really strong connection with the character of Marty, especially because of the representation in that film as well. And then also some really interesting kind of religious iconography going on. But I'm still sticking with Alien and The Thing.
Also excellent choices.
Those are ones that I have watched so many times I've lost count. So those are going to be they tie.
Have you seen Slashback yet?
I haven't seen it yet. No, I'm behind on my Shudder releases.
So that is like the logical extension to that kind of Alien / The Thing genre, I think.
Fantastic. I think the weirdest one I saw in the last year was The Seed.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's 1980. When was that?
Oh, no. This is The Seed that came out in 2021.
Oh, okay. I have like this distinct memory of like a VHS cover, and so I might be thinking of something similarly named. But okay, you're talking about the Mojave
Desert. There's so much going on, and I don't want to spoil, because at first, I mean, even Significant Other that came out directly to Paramount Plus. I'm not spoiling anything by saying I went into that not realizing there were aliens.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's a spoiler, really. Like, you guys should watch it. It's wacky.
You know, they do make a new version of The Seed for every generation. So it's easy to get thrown off by what year it came out.
I just have to shout out that Slashback that you mentioned, Hub, is a Canadian film. Yes. So props to my fellow Canadians. Set in Nunavut, which is very, very rare to see a movie set in Nunavut. So
yeah, it's
kind of cool.
I really have come to appreciate, like, because of the passing of Jeff Barnaby, the fact that there is this kind of trend of Indigenous people's horror, you know, telling horror stories under that, or like through that lens. And I think that's just, I think that's going to be really like the next, as more Indigenous creators get opportunities and our finance, I think we're going to see a whole new, I really hope, I should say, that we see a whole new generation of storytelling through that lens. And, and Slashback is, man, so good. I that's when I think and much like Gremlins, which I did show to my kids, except for one part, which we'll talk about later. Like, I feel like Slashback's one you can show the kids, because there's kids in it and they're doing heroic things.
Yeah. Unlike Blood Quantum, which you probably shouldn't show kids.
No, not until they're a little older. I told them they can see Terrifier 2 when they're 21. Blood Quantum may be a little younger.
So, Enola, you already answered your first horror movie you remember seeing.
I'm sorry. It's hard for me to talk about horror without at least mentioning it. That's just comes so natural.
I have to say, though, I did not see Silver Bullet until this year, which is very, very unusual, because I love creature features. I love Stephen King, and I love Corey Haim. So why this was the first year I saw it, I don't know.
I'll say, for the longest time, I thought that it was filmed in Canada and that it was a Canadian horror film, because like the two of the leads are Canadian, and I just assumed that it was. But it's shot in North Carolina. So there you go.
All right. So Hub, what was your first horror movie you remember seeing?
So this is kind of a double answer, because I remember very little. I can't confirm this. My parents don't remember going to the drive-in and seeing Poltergeist. I have some weird vivid memories of it. I kind of feel like it would have been irresponsible for them to let me see Poltergeist at that age. When did that come out? Was that 81 or something? I mean, I would have been really little when that came out. 82. Okay. So I would have been about 4 if they saw it at the drive-in when it freshly came out, you know, unless it was some sort of revival that showed later. But I feel like I would have more distinct memory of it. But I have a very distinct memory of, are you familiar with a TV movie called Don't Go to Sleep?
No.
That sounds very familiar.
Yeah, this was, it was directed by Richard Lang, written by Ned Wynn. It had Dennis Weaver, Valerie Harper, Ruth Gordon, and it was kind of like, honestly, Hereditary. It was like a precursor to Hereditary in a really weird way. But like TV movie, right? And the most vivid, like, frightening thing that stuck with me is, and it's funny, Brian W. Collins, who used to do the birth. He did columns on Birth Movies Death, and he has the Horror Movie a Day blog. He remembers, he's like the only other person I've ever talked to who remembers this. Like, there's this weird like pizza cutter scene where like the creepy little girl is like carving up this pizza, like just carving up the hell out of it. And like, you know, she's going to, you know, go after somebody with that. And you can find it on YouTube, and it's just, like, just look up like Don't Go to Sleep pizza cutter scene, and you'll see it, and you can see why that would have scared like a, you know, 3 or 4 year old kid back in the '80s.
I think the entire movie's on YouTube, actually.
Oh, probably. Yeah. That's good.
I'll have to check it out. Who is your ultimate final girl?
It's easy for me. It's Ripley.
Oh, good one.
Yes.
Also, mostly because I resonate and identify with not just Ripley as a character, but just the whole gender nonconformity of that entire film.
Yeah. Yeah, fair. I think she's probably one of the first that like just really like knocked me off my feet, where I was just like, you are incredible. Like, just blew me away.
Yeah, I think originally for me, I was most interested in Laurie Strode because Halloween was one of my favorite films for a really long time. And I'd seen Alien, but I'd seen Aliens more because I was a child. So at the time with my brothers, Aliens was more exciting than Alien. But I've come back and Alien is my movie, and Ripley is definitely my final girl through and through.
Hub, what about you?
So this is going to have spoilers for a 2020 movie called Terror at Bigfoot Pond. It was directed by David Rimbaldi. It was shot in New Mexico. It's a found footage, shot on video movie about a bunch of college kids who basically go to a hole that passes for a pond and camp out, and then one by one get picked off by a Bigfoot. And the first time you watch it, you're like, this is terrible. And then the second time you watch it, you see the hidden eccentric brilliance of it. And here's the spoiler. The final girl is a character named Kelly. She's played by Emerald Fowler. And what makes her the ultimate final girl is, first, she's one of the very few black women who end up the final girl, let alone survive a horror movie. I think we're all familiar with the cliche of, like, you know, the black person in the cast being the first to be picked off, right? She survives the whole thing. Second of all, you see, like, you know all these movies, all these slasher movies, camp movies. I think we can agree, like, the kids are dumb, right? Like, it's just the most obnoxious teens getting high, getting drunk, having sex, and you know they're going to die. And sometimes, you know, this movie especially, you kind of want to see it happen because they're that annoying. They're like doing drum circles. They're having like this nonsense conversation that you can only find in like improv shot on video movies. And so they all react in the stupid ways you'd expect stupid horror characters to act when the threat pops up. But she like secludes herself in a cave. She starts breaking out all these tools and like forming them like MacGyver. She's like looking at the sky and talking about, like, she's doing these soliloquies to the camera, talking about, you know, astronomy and knowing that this star position means that she needs to go this way as north and blah, blah, blah. And you're like, what happened to like that dumb girl who was at the pond? Like, she's suddenly some sort of genius. And like, she's the one final girl I've seen who like never slips up. Like, you know, Nancy in Elm Street finally slips up. There's been a couple of incarnations of Laurie Strode who finally slips up, and like, just, you don't sleep on Kelly from Bigfoot Pond. She always wins in the end. It's great. And then she still has the, you know, traumatized Sally Hardesty-esque ride in a stranger's truck away from the scene of the massacre where she's the lone survivor. But, you know, I think she has a lot to be proud of.
Oh, I'll have to check it out. So the first time you watch it, you'll think this is garbage. But the second time you start to see the genius in it. That's what you said, right?
Absolutely. Because
so give it another shot.
Okay. I mean, there at one point the Bigfoot puts on one of the GoPros. I mean, That tells you right there what kind of humor you're dealing with. But you don't notice that stuff until maybe a second viewing.
How long would you last in a horror movie?
So I thought about this a lot, and I even heard some of the answers from your previous guests. And what I realized was, I'm not a hero. I wouldn't be a final boy or girl. I think, though, I'm the person who ends up on the gurney giving the thumbs up at the end. So I'm in bad shape, but I still make it out.
I see. Okay. You're the...
So like the Dewey from Scream.
At least for several of the movies, yes.
Okay.
Anola, what about you?
This is a hard one because I would like to think that I will survive the like apocalypse. And I had I read the survival guide. I met Max Brooks, but like, physical fitness wise, I'm probably not going to survive. Not if we're talking fast zombies, like new age zombies. If we're talking like, you know, Romero's, you know, Day of the Dead, sure. Unless Bob has that gun. But yeah, so I realistically, no. In my fantasy, yes.
I realized the other day who I would be in a horror movie, because I always say I wouldn't last long. Like, I'm very clumsy. I trip over my own feet randomly. Like, I would not last. But yeah, then same. I decided, no, I wouldn't even like be a victim. I'd survive. But I was watching Scream 2, and there's the scene at the very beginning. Not the very beginning, but it's when you see Sydney again, and her roommate are outside in the hallway talking in their dorm. And the girl comes up and she goes, "Oh my gosh, you guys, check out the news." And I was like, that would be me. I'd be the check out the news girl. I wouldn't even feature in a horror movie.
You're not the star. Yeah, I'm probably not either.
Like, your character wouldn't even have a name in the credits, yeah. Just like the hallway girl.
I have a one-liner, or I personally really want to do episodes about queer analysis in the Scream films. And I'm one of those sorority girls, maybe. I'm positive.
Hi. No, I mean it.
Yeah. You know, those peripheral characters are like, so you know about the Friday the 13th revival that is apparently mm-hmm. happening with Brian Fuller?
Yes.
So I really want to play young, sexy, crazy Ralph.
Yes. And find out why he ended up the way he was.
My theory, and I haven't talked to Mr. Fuller about this yet, but I mainly because he doesn't return my calls. But my theory is that he was jilted by Mrs. Voorhees. I think he had a thing for her, but
do you think he's Jason's real dad?
No, not at all. I think he saw a chance where he could step up and be a father figure. For, you know, the absent father, for Jason, but she just, you know, she's more into those sweaters and revenge, you know?
Excellent. All right. Well, let's start talking about Gremlins. The Letterboxd summary: when Billy Peltzer is given a strange but adorable pet named Gizmo for Christmas, he inadvertently breaks the three important rules of caring for Mogwai and unleashes a horde of mischievous gremlins on a small town. So my first question for you is, do you remember the first time you saw Gremlins?
I do not, but I know it was on VHS. I guarantee I rented this when I was in junior high or high school. There's no way I saw it in the theater, because my parents would not have taken like 10-year-old Steve to go see Gremlins. Maybe Temple of Doom, which came out the same summer, but yeah, not this.
I'm pretty sure I saw this early in my induction into horror films, my introduction. So when I was 5, that's when I think I saw Silver Bullet. So this was probably around the same time period, specifically a summer where we were watching, you know, my grandmother had the TV guide and we were watching lots of horror movies. So if this was on TV reruns at the time, then that's when I would have seen it.
Could you remember the excitement of getting the new TV guide and like flipping through and seeing what was coming out like next week?
I don't think we got it. My grandmother got it, but we didn't get TV guide. Like, I'd steal my grandmother's TV guide.
I would flip through the one that came in the Sunday newspaper.
Okay. Yes. Yeah.
No, I was all about the TV guides. You know, it's funny. My older sister thought that To Be Announced was the name of a show. And she
always thought that was on Silver Bullet. I remember when they started doing the VCR plus codes, and that seemed so exotic and advanced, where you'd put in a 6-digit code and it would know to record your thing. You didn't have to tell it what time.
Gosh. Yeah. That you unearthed a memory. Just like we were a VHS family or beta family or whatever. But, you know, so this came out home media in 1985.
Mm-hmm. So okay, yeah. So that's the year I was born. So give me 5 years, and then I probably then saw it on home. It could have been on VHS, but we would have rented it.
Yeah, for sure. Same here. I mean, I was you know, a little kid, 6 or 7 or 8 or whatever. But yeah, this is definitely one I have a distinct memory of seeing New Batch, you know, the sequel, in theaters with my grandma, actually. But this one, I know that I would have had to see on home video.
Yeah, I saw New Batch in the theater with friends. But yeah, this one definitely, it would have been friends who rented this. I don't think my parents would have let me whip out the old Blockbuster card for this one.
Yeah, I don't remember. It probably the same. Like, I would have seen it at a friend's house or something. I don't have a very distinct memory of seeing it. I do have a distinct memory of seeing another movie that came out the same day that this did. But we'll get to that in a minute.
Is it Ghostbusters?
It was Ghostbusters. Yep. Yeah.
I have lots of distinct memories about
Ghostbusters. I was born in 1976, so I would have been 8 when this came out, and Ghostbusters came out the same day, and Ghostbusters was the first movie I was allowed to go see on my own with a friend, and her parents dropped us off and then picked us up after the movie. And now when I look back, I'm like, first of all, I had terrible night terrors when I was young, like awful, and I wasn't allowed to watch anything remotely scary. So I can't believe that they let me go see Ghostbusters on my own. And like, I mean, it's a little scary in parts, and yeah, not something that an 8-year-old would normally go see. However, there was no PG-13 rating at the time, so
you could walk right in.
Yeah, bless the PG era of the 80s. Those are some of my favorite films still to this day. Mm-hmm. Like right there with Hub with Poltergeist.
Yeah.
Except for the one scene, you know what I'm talking about, in the kitchen, like in the bathroom. I absolutely loved it as a child.
That scene is terrifying. It is terrifying. All right. So Gremlins was directed by Joe Dante, written by Chris Columbus. And it was originally not even supposed to be a movie that was going to be made. It was supposed to be a spec film. It was just supposed to showcase Chris Columbus's writing talents. But Steven Spielberg got it and was like, I really like this. I want to see this made. And he picked Joe Dante to direct.
And he was so proud of it too, Spielberg. Like, he was so proud that he found this story and was like, I own this story. I'm gonna make this thing happen. Like, he really is.
Yeah.
And you see it all through the film, you know, with references to his stuff. You know, like, I mean, there was very much like a lovey-dovey relationship between this story, this script, and Spielberg.
Mm-hmm.
I just love the fact that Steven Spielberg, who we all think of as like this wholesome, like makes family films, his two movies that came out the same year were pretty much responsible for making a PG-13 rating because they were just too intense.
Yes.
Like, he directed Temple of Doom. He produced this one.
Well, yeah. He also was going, he wanted to direct Poltergeist.
Oh, that's right.
Which was 1982. So that was a little earlier, but it like paving the way towards a PG-13 rating.
Columbus got the idea for the story when he would hear mice in his loft at night, and he said what sounded like a platoon of mice would come out, and to hear them skittering around in the blackness was really creepy. Gremlins first entered the cultural lexicon during the 1920s when there were failures in Royal Air Force aircraft that were blamed on gremlins, and Raoul Dahl, the writer of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, had been an RAF pilot, and he published a book called Gremlins in 1943, which Walt Disney actually considered making a movie of, but it never happened.
Can you imagine if they had hit it, if Disney had hit Gremlins first? like can you imagine Gremlins all over the, you know, over Disneyland Park and like
they would not look like this, I think, though. Like, right? Like, they would look, I think that the look that they had for this film, like, Disney would have gone in a very different direction.
Yeah, I think like the Mogwai would probably look similar, maybe, right. But the Gremlin, the Gremlins, I think, would still
it would just be a Mogwai with horns. But that's really interesting. I did not know that, and I love that. In a sense, this kind of derives from, you know, folklore and mm-hmm. myths and urban legends and stuff. And I think for me, some of my favorite films come from that. So That's exciting.
Yeah, it definitely hits. I mean, I know we'll talk about all this when we talk about the themes of it, but just the fact that the kind of, it runs deep. Like, you know, like we said, the origins of it go so far, so much farther back. And really, like, I mean, if we want to get really lofty about it, if we look at the history of miniature beasts and homunculi and all sorts mm-hmm. of things, this definitely taps into something very primal in our storytelling.
There's also a Bugs Bunny cartoon called Falling Hair, which features Bugs Bunny battling a gremlin on an airplane.
Well, there's also the Shadow in the Cloud movie that came out, I think, 2 years ago, where Chloe Grace Moretz plays, I think, a pilot or someone who works on an aircraft in World War II. And it's a bonkers movie that involves gremlins.
I think it's on my watch list and I still haven't gotten around to it. And unfortunately, it had a lot of promotion. I saw a lot of promotion, but like, then you just never hear about it again.
Really. It is ridiculous, but it is fun. I mean, she might be miscast. Like, I would buy her being able to like heal a horse by putting her hand on its flank rather than like fly a plane and shoot down other planes.
I love Chloe Grace Moretz, but she's been miscast in a lot of films.
Yes. Like Carrie. But, it's big, dumb fun.
The Twilight Zone story preceded this as well, right? I mean, obviously there's the William Shatner mm-hmm. version, but even like the John Lithgow, actually Joe Dante directed that segment, didn't he, in the Twilight Zone movie?
Did he? I didn't know that.
Yeah, with the I want to say Nightmare at, let's get the number of feet right.
That was 30,000 feet, but I'm not sure.
Let's see. It's Nightmare at 20,000 feet.
Oh,
Price is Right rules.
Exactly. I lose. That story, you know, that episode comes out in 63 with Shatner, but then they remake it. I thought it was. You know what, Joe? What did Joe Dante do in that movie? I know that he was involved with Twilight Zone. Maybe not that segment, though. But that's how him and Spielberg knew each other.
I think, yeah. And also Spielberg was a fan of The Howling, I think.
Yes. Which I love the little Howling reference. At one point, they open like a fridge and there's the little smiley face sticker.
Oh, yeah. It's been a while since I've seen The Howling. And I think The Howling 7 scarred me.
Have you seen them all?
Yes.
Dante did the Cornfields Kid segment of that movie.
It's a Good Life, isn't it?
And Spielberg directed that movie. So yeah, that's how they came together.
And you know, I actually found out that I knew Joe Dante was involved with Rock and Roll High School, the Ramones movie.
He was?
Yeah. So he actually is an uncredited director on it. I think Alan Arkush is the name of the person who gets credited with it. And at some point he kind of was out of commission. He was, you know, exhaustion is what they say. And I don't know what that's from. I don't know if he was just stressed or if he just was in really bad health, but Joe Dante was actually behind the camera for a lot of that. And there's like this terrible remake with Corey Feldman called, a sequel, Rock and Roll High School Forever. They replaced the Ramones with The Pursuit of Happiness. I'm sorry, that's a step down. But they make like a 666 Dante Circle reference in that movie as like kind of their tribute to
oh my gosh.
Dante being uncredited director of the first one.
I know that Rock and Roll High School was one of the Roger Corman School of Filmmaking, and Joe Dante came out of there. Mm-hmm. And Dick Miller was a big player there, and he plays Mr. Futterman in this.
Yes.
And Paul Bartel is in the sequel as a theater manager, and he's in a bunch of these movies.
Yeah. Like, yeah, it's weird that this was kind of like the big budget culmination. I know it wasn't planned as a big budget movie, but I mean, it ended up being like an $11 million movie to make, which I think was the, I mean, I think that's a lot now. But I think that was, you know, a lot mm-hmm. then, back then too. In you know, when they were shooting it in 83 or 84, to think that this is kind of the culmination of the Roger Corman school of filmmaking and like,
yeah.
the players, you know, and then Spielberg gets involved and you've got like the biggest B movie ever, you know.
Yeah.
So the original script was actually much darker, and we'll talk a little bit about the plot in a couple of minutes. But originally, Billy's mom was actually killed by the gremlins. And when Billy gets home, they tossed her head down the stairs. The gremlins eat Barney the dog. And the gremlins also attack a McDonald's. And instead of Big Macs, they eat customers. Very different tone, I feel like.
Yeah, now I want to see the Damien Leone version of that movie.
Yeah. I feel like it makes sense why they went into the – I think Spielberg was in a time period where he wanted kids to be able to come to things that were scary
mm-hmm.
with your whole family. Like, this is ridiculousness for your whole family. So I mostly see why they didn't make Gizmo transform into Stripe. They made Stripe, you know, his own evil entity.
Yes. Yeah.
Because, like, we get – no matter what, we get a lovable little hero out of it.
Gizmo as the final girl.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
In a Barbie car.
In a Barbie car. And then he goes full Rambo in the sequel. It's great.
Oh, boy.
So the movie stars Zach Galligan, Phoebe Cates, Hoyt Axton, Polly Holiday, and Francis Lee McCain, with Howie Mandel voicing Gizmo.
I was excited to find out that Howie Mandel was there kind of on the behest of Frank Welker. That at the time he might not have necessarily been as known for voiceover stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I think Howie Mandel in 84 would have been known for like stand-up comedy and being on St. Elsewhere. Because I know he did voices like his character Bobby, which he turned into Bobby's World, I think.
Right.
He was doing that in stand-up, but I don't think he did a ton of voiceover.
What year did Little Monsters come out? That back to me.
Was that 88 or 89 somewhere?
Yeah, I was thinking 89.
Okay. Not a voiceover, just that was my film for Mandel growing up.
Yeah, no, for sure. Well, that's the wild thing is that, you know, I think he got on a path of kind of doing the, and I know Michael Winslow was involved with the voices as well, and Police Academy, I think, was concurrent to this.
Yeah.
Just kind of the idea of Frank Welker, like, rallying the troops as far as here's some guys you can count on. And so it's really cool. Fred Newman, you know, who did the Mouth Sounds book, and he was on a lot of the like Nickelodeon stuff, like the early shows.
Nice.
And so it's kind of a who's who of voiceover folks. The voiceover community, which I am not a member of, I'm just an admirer looking on from the outside, but they really stick together.
That's nice though. I like it. Very like,
yeah,
lovely.
When they announced what's his name as the new Mario,
like, Chris Pratt.
Oh yeah.
That guy, like there was people coming out. Like I know Tara Strong, who's Raven and Harley Quinn and a bunch of voices, for like DC stuff. Like she was just out the gate, like, not a fan, you know, they definitely stick together.
So the movie was released on June 8th, 1984, which we already mentioned was also the same weekend that Ghostbusters came out. Hub, you mentioned that the budget was $11 million. Their box office was $212.9 million.
That's so much. Like, and they did a re-release later and added like 90 more, didn't they?
Yeah.
So you're walking away in mid 1980s money with $300 million box office once you figure in worldwide and home media sales and stuff.
Right.
That's a respectable figure today. I mean, it's also like the budget of a Marvel movie now, but you know,
yeah,
that's
good for a little thing about some of these great 80s horror films is like a lot of box office like bombs essentially because of opening weekend or the first couple of weeks. But the ones that, you know, were found on home video or got this second release because of that community that sort of came together behind them, but it was just slow to catch on. That's what's super fun about a lot of these. And Gremlins is one of those.
Well, yeah. And they would be in theaters for, you know, 6 months.
It's true.
So, and then they would go into like the second run theaters where you'd pay a dollar.
Yeah.
Man, I miss the dollar movie theater.
So do I.
Oh, same.
Where's that?
I promise this isn't a plug. It's fresh on my mind. So I just on my show did a deep dive into the Rob Zombie filmography. And what's I learned besides just, you know, certain things about his own storytelling methods and his universe of characters and things like that, I really looked deep into like the budget and then the resulting box office. And it's wild to see how like his first couple movies, you know, spend a little, make a lot, spend a little, make a lot. And then as time has gone on, and I think it's a good microcosm for the film industry in general, it's like, just like these diminishing returns and having to do more on smaller and smaller budgets. And so that's why something like we were talking about Terrifier 2, you know, comes along and spends tens of thousands of dollars, maybe hundreds of thousands, and then makes millions on return. Like that's more in the spirit of getting back to like what stuff was doing in the 80s and in the 90s of really being able to bet on these little movies that end up raking in a lot. Mm-hmm. But it's just wild to see how, you know, like I said, Rob Zombie, if you look at a 20-year career and you see how the amounts start changing. So to think of that in terms of 80s money and how much they were able, I bet we're not even figuring in like merchandise sales or anything like that.
Which was huge, huge for this movie for sure.
Yeah.
There's like, we're talking like 40 years of Gizmo dolls. My 4-year-old who has seen the movie once, like wants a Gizmo doll. Like barely knows what the, you know, really gets what the movie's about.
Not to mention ripoffs like the Furby.
Yeah.
I actually have a Gizmo action figure and I took it. I went a few years ago, went to Spain, and I have pictures of Gizmo just in random spots in Spain because I was going by myself and I'm like, why not? Let's add a little whimsy to my trip. So
I need to see that gallery when you publicize. When you publicize this episode, please share those photos.
I will. There's one in particular, and it's Gizmo on a bar. And at the end is just this, like, grumpy-looking old man, like, staring down, like, what is this thing on the bar?
That was the American movie critic reaction to this movie, representing one photo.
Gremlins was the fourth highest-grossing film of the year. Any guesses what the other three were?
So got to be Ghostbusters.
Mm-hmm.
I assume Temple of Doom.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, like, did Officer and a Gentleman come out that year or something? I don't.
I'm going to assume a re-release of It's a Mad, 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 Mad World.
Beverly Hills Cop.
Oh, yes.
Oh, man, Judge Reinhold did good for himself.
He was mad about this, though. He was mad that he got most of his scenes got cut out of Gremlins.
Because Jonathan Banks is the deputy in this, and he's also in Beverly Hills Cop as well.
You keep waiting for him to give like a half measure speech to Billy.
So speaking of critics' response to the movie, Roger Ebert gave it 3 out of 4 stars, said that it was fun, but also a sly series of send-ups and parodied many elemental film storylines. Gene Siskel gave it 3.5 out of 4 stars, said that it was a wickedly funny and slightly sick ride. And a most original work, we're aware at every moment that someone is trying to entertain us. Playfulness abounds. Vincent Canby of the New York Times was mixed, saying that the film is far more interested in showing off its knowledge of movie lore and making random jokes than in providing consistent entertainment. Unfortunately, it's funniest when being most nasty.
Sherry, on the Texas Chainsaw Massacre episode you did, you went over the Ebert review, right?
Probably.
And he actually liked that movie, mm-hmm. didn't he? And the reason I bring this up is because I feel like, and I've been guilty.
He
of
also
this.
Liked Silver Bullet. I'm
just gonna put that out there. There you go.
Nice.
I'm one of these people who, you know, I have horror content, and I was going to go into a thing doing voiceover about like Roger Ebert reviews, and Ebert notoriously hates horror. And if you actually look at it, that's not true at all. He champions stuff like this, and you know, Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Like he. You know, I definitely didn't agree with everything he ever said about movies in general, let alone horror movies. Him and Siskel could be kind of clutch their pearls sometimes at things that I think we wouldn't think is a big deal now. But he said about this that it was I don't want to get. I know we'll talk about the scene. There's a certain monologue by a certain gal in the movie.
Yes,
a certain amazing monologue.
What a tearjerker.
Yeah. And he said it was like the 1950s sick jokes.
Yes.
And I I don't know about that's an area I don't know, and I don't know about 1956 jokes. Maybe one of y'all can educate me, but
I think it's okay to say, I mean, we already said at the beginning of this that spoilers. So I'm just gonna say Phoebe Cates gives the monologue. I know they were worried about casting her in this because of Fast Times at Ridgemont High, but I feel that this one monologue is just proof that she has great dramatic range. And I am saddened that I didn't see her in more dramatic work over the course of her career. Although I love Drop Dead Fred.
Yes.
Yeah.
That monologue is heartbreaking. Like, she does such a great job at like delivering it and just absolutely like wrenching your heart out of your chest.
It's amazing. And then with great comic timing in the second Gremlins movie, she makes fun of that. They make fun of that, and she delivers that so well too. It's pretty great.
Isn't it like Lincoln's birthday or
it's
something?
It's Lincoln's birthday. Yes. If I was an actor, I would audition with her monologue in this movie.
I love it. There is one critic that absolutely hated it, saying, calling it icky, gross, saying that despite being set in a picture postcard town and blending the feel of It's a Wonderful Life with that of The Blob, the film is negated by too vivid violence and mayhem. He gave it 2 out of 4 stars. That was Leonard Maltin, who would appear in Gremlins 2.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Leonard Maltin has such a good sense of humor about himself. Like, he, when I was living in Los Angeles for several years, he would make a lot of appearances at Upright Citizens Brigade Theater. He would go talk about his career, like on Doug Benson's show. That guy gets it. It's weird that he didn't like this first one, but I mean, what a way to double down by then giving the same review in the
exactly.
On camera.
I don't know if it's, yeah. Yeah, we'll go with that.
So the film was nominated for 9 Saturn Awards. It won 5. So it won Best Horror Film, Best Director, Best Supporting Actress for Polly Holiday, Best Music, which we didn't talk about, but we will talk about because I think it's fantastic. We can get to that later for Jerry Goldsmith. And it also won Best Special Effects for Chris Wallace. It was nominated for Best Supporting Actor for Dick Miller, but Tracy Walter won for Repo Man. Best Younger Actor for Corey Feldman, but Noah Hathaway won for The Neverending Story. Best Writing, James Cameron and Gail Ann Hurd won that for Terminator. Best Makeup for Greg LaCava, but lost to Stan Winston for Terminator as well.
I mean, that shows you like the caliber of folks who it took to beat that movie for those awards, because those are like all... Those are all iconic performers and creators for sure.
I think Noah deserved it. I would not have nominated Corey Feldman in this movie.
No, I love Corey Feldman in this movie.
I think that he gives a much better performance in a few other films as, I mean, young actor, if that's the category.
That's true. Yeah.
He's kind of inconsequential. His character's kind of inconsequential in this movie. I mean, except for like knocking over the water.
Say, yeah. Right.
He has an important plot point.
I think that's what it is that he doesn't have, there's not a lot of, I don't want to say grit, but there isn't a lot of substance to his character. So why I'm surprised.
I think part of that is because they imagined the Billy character as his age. Like, Billy was originally supposed to be a lot younger.
Which makes sense because you think, why are these two friends?
Yes. And why does he have like little robot toys and things like that?
It's like, how old was Billy supposed to be was a thought I kept having.
He's working at a bank. They've graduated high school, clearly.
Is he the Doogie Howser equivalent of bank tellers? And he's just really good at it at a really young age.
I think that if you listen to what Judge Reinhold's character says at one point, I think they've maybe been out of high school for like a year or two. Because I think Billy is saving up for college.
That's what the bank situation is.
So I don't think they've been out of high school long, but he is someone who's out of high school. And how old is Corey Feldman? Like, he's supposed to be 10 or 11, maybe?
Something like that. Maybe he 12. Used to babysit him or something. And so that's how
I think he did.
Yeah. Let's go with that. So we're going to go into a quick plot synopsis. So the movie opens in Chinatown in some unnamed American city. I'm guessing from the second movie that it's New York. We meet Randall Peltzer, also known as Rand. He's an inventor of unique products like the Bathroom Buddy, and he's going into an antique store. And while he's there, he encounters this strange little creature called a Mogwai. He decides he wants to buy it, but the proprietor of the shop, Mr. Wing, refuses. He's like, he's not for sale. He won't take any money for it. His grandson, however, knowing that the family needs money, sneaks the Mogwai outside and sells it to Randall. For, what was it, $200? Is it $200?
It's a lot, and it's not like, it doesn't seem like this family is doing really well financially. So $200 impulse purchase on a little furball seems excessive.
Mm-hmm. It's weird because he's buying his son a birthday gift and it's Christmas. So I'm pretty sure it's his birthday. So that's why like Billy's like, here, have this. And then or he gets it to it. I'm like, I don't know why we had to do the birthday thing when it was Christmas. But maybe he said he was buying him a Christmas present. I think that's what it says. But at the same time, I'm positive there was something about a birthday in there. I probably made this up.
I don't remember anything about a birthday, but I might have been distracted by the fact that he put shaving cream and toothpaste in that little Bathroom Buddy when a hotel will really give you those for free and you don't need them.
Did they used to? He was staying in roadside motels.
That is true.
I don't think he was getting complimentary
toiletries.
Toiletries, yeah. But I love Rand. Randall. When do we call him Rand in this film? Never. but I love Randall because, oh gosh, he's just, none of his inventions need to happen. Like there's no, I don't know why he thinks they're necessary.
He's literally a confident, mediocre white man.
And then like, look who else is at that convention that he's coming from.
Mm-hmm.
All mediocre white men. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, except for the one who apparently has a functional time machine in the background.
Yes. Yes.
And Spielberg goes by on a recumbent bike.
That's true. I never noticed. To this day, it wasn't paying attention.
What did y'all think of Mr. Wing? Because
I'm uncomfortable with him now.
It is classic 80s casual racism. Just like in how I keep bringing up the second one, but just like the Getty Watanabe character who is just an Asian character who can't stop taking pictures.
But it's like, you know, Key Luke was, I mean, he's like one of the founding members of the Screen Actors Guild. Like he's no, you know, day player.
Well,
he's,
true.
This is like a serious dude. And I felt like he lended an integrity to that role that maybe kept it from being just, you know, a stereotype.
Oh, and
And how it's bookended.
I don't know that it's his character so much as the English lines from the grandson that sort of make it now feel like the stereotyping or the casual racism. I don't think it was even his representation of the character itself. It was more the way that he's talked about by his grandson afterward.
Right.
And if this movie was made today, it would guaranteed be played by James Hong, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
The grandson tells him three very important rules about the Mogwai. He says, do not expose him to light, especially sunlight, because it's fatal. Don't let him come into contact with water. And above all, never feed it after midnight. So it actually sounds like the Mogwai is harder to take care of than an actual child. But I say that as a childless person, I don't know.
Yes.
Here's the thing. It's always after midnight somewhere. So.
I think as a kid, I assumed that when is it not after midnight? Like technically it's after midnight last night. So as a kid, I kind of in my head assumed it was like dawn, but it's.
No, it's always 5 o'clock somewhere.
That's true.
Right. Well, and then with this, is it just like, I guess if they eat within the hour after midnight, it's more probably accurate if I'm thinking about it and not overthinking of. Well, it's after midnight somewhere.
But wait, they feed the one in the lab, or he feeds himself at like 2:30 in the morning.
Well, I don't know about Gremlins 2. I'm talking about. Oh wait,
no, this is the high school.
The high school. Lab. Yeah, sorry. Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Sorry, I got mixed up with multiple labs. That is such a great. We'll get into it, but I'm like, there's a lot of great scenes in this film.
There are.
Maybe the Gremlins are into intermittent fasting. And it's just, they can only eat for 2 hours a day, or not eat for 2 hours a day.
Right. I mean, that would explain their, you know, great figures. So
yeah. I feel like the high school science scene from the faculty is inspired by the...
Yes, I thought the exact same thing. So Randall returns home to the small town of Kingston Falls, and he gifts the Mogwai to his son, Billy. And he's like, oh, I named him Gizmo. So Billy's a stand-up guy. He's really supporting his family, but he's made enemies with this rich widow named Mrs. Deagle. But really, pretty much everybody in town seems to be enemies of Mrs. Deagle.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like reminiscent of The Wizard of Oz with so Billy works in a bank, as we mentioned, and Mrs. Deagle is walking down the like street, and she's got like a snowman head, like a porcelain snowman head in her arms. And she walks into the bank and she really wants Billy's dog Barney dead. Like it's very, like she is very much the Margaret Hamilton in The Wizard of Oz.
I mean, once she's in her house, she's a full on Pearl character.
she is.
And it's funny. She was like America's most beloved waitress at one time. She was Flo.
Pete is the aforementioned young boy who is inexplicably friends with Billy. And he comes over one night and accidentally breaks rule number two when he spills water on Gizmo.
See, now the shopkeeper only explained the consequences of the light. He didn't explain the consequences of the water or the feeding after midnight.
Which are really the bigger, like, well, maybe not the
bigger. Like, if you say, if you give them some chicken after midnight, they will turn into hideous murder beasts. Maybe he'd be more careful.
I'm not sure that the grandson knew.
Yeah, maybe the grandson just knew, like, kind of the, here are the rules, but he didn't know the whys.
That's true.
It's like, I know why we keep him in this box, but I don't know why we can't put water on him.
So we quickly learn why you shouldn't expose the Mogwai to water. It causes more Mogwai to spawn. And they're not like Gizmo. Like, Gizmo's very cute. He's sweet. He loves to sing. And they seem to be led by Stripe, who is named so after his puffy white mohawk.
I gotta ask Enola something here.
Yeah.
Because you mentioned at the beginning of our conversation how you like looking at things from a queer lens, right? Like you like to do a queer reading of a text?
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, I will. I
used to. Yeah, yeah. So I think that there's a lot of interesting things afoot about gender in the Gremlins movies. Because they, you know, we read them as male, really up until the point that you, like, specifically have a female gremlin in number two. But, like, they're capable of reproduction. Mm-hmm. And I know that, you know, that's
they are going more into, the queen, like, from Alien. But yeah. But she, the thing about the queen from Alien and a lot about what, aliens, and a lot about what bothers me about Aliens is that they totally took all that amazing lack of a binary in Alien and turned it all around. I could rant about the fact that also now she's like a mom and the mom vibes are coming out. But anyway, so yes, I see it. It's like, it's very similar to any creature that can produce without having sex organs, without having a defined gender. And they do get read as male, I think, because of the activities in the bar specifically.
Mm-hmm. But except there is one gremlin who could be male and just dressed in female presenting. I don't know. But
there is a little light love sequence in the point where the gremlins are. I think it's in the bar. But there's something, there's just a little nod to the fact that maybe they aren't male.
It is the ultimate asexual reproduction when you just get water spilled on you and all of a sudden there's...
That's one of my favorite scenes. And the sounds coming out of that pool. Mm.
Oh, yeah.
So in a small town, similar to the faculty, as you mentioned, who's your expert on zoology? Well, your science teacher or your former science teacher. So Billy teams up with Mr. Hansen and Mr. Hansen starts experimenting on a Mogwai. At this point, Stripe and his squad are ready to bust loose, and they very cleverly trick Billy into feeding them after midnight, while Mr. Hansen's Mogwai manages to sneak a sandwich into his cage. And now we find out what happens when you feed a Mogwai after midnight. They enter a pupal stage before hatching into their new green reptilian forms.
And those things were gross. Probably the grossest thing in the movie are the cocoons.
Yes, they're disgusting. There's
some really good goo in this film.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I was going to say they're very goopy. Yeah.
And I prefer goo to gore, if that makes any sense. Like, if it's gooey without... So any of the films where you have gore that is, like, it's really gory, but it's not necessarily the traditional coloration of human matter, let's put it that way. I am really into it. And then it gets too real, and I'm just like, I could vomit.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
This is great.
These gremlins are a lot more aggressive, and they start to go on the attack. First, they go after Gizmo. Go after Billy's mom while the gremlin at the school kills Mr. Hansen. And Billy and his mom manage to kill all of the gremlins except for the ringleader, Stripe, which is a bad idea.
I did appreciate how the gremlins come at Billy's mom like the bad guys come at Steven Seagal in one of his movies. They just wait till the other one is defeated and then they take their turn.
Like, Lynn kicks some ass.
Yeah.
She really does.
She does. Stripe manages to get away, and he heads to the YMCA, where he's able to form his own little gremlin army by jumping into the pool. And then Kingston Falls is a war zone after that. The gremlins are going bonkers all over town. It is amazing. They're going after people with snowplows. They launch Mrs. Deagle through her window after messing with her motorized stair lift.
That motorized stair lift goes up and goes so far. It feels like she's on the 18th floor when she leaves.
Like, they're... Phones are ringing off the hook at the police station, and the only couple of, police officers in the town or sheriff's people, whoever they are, then their car gets messed with. I think it explodes. It becomes an action film, full stop. And then we have, of course, the tractor.
Oh, yeah.
Which that was really violent, but you don't really see it, right? Because they don't show like the gore of the tractor scene or anything like that. So
no.
There's definitely a lot of murder they get away with because they're not showing the end.
There's like a weird continuity thing here. And it's really odd because I know the whole thing about like Spielberg wanting to make it less dark and stuff. Like, you could have gotten away with nobody actually getting killed in this as far as humans. But it does appear that there are humans killed. But then... apparently doesn't Phoebe Cates have a line in the sequel talking about how, oh, fortunately nobody was killed.
Like, except that that car explodes.
Yeah. And also like the Futtermans. And I remember like I was writing my notes and I wrote like body count and I was kind of going off of memory and I wrote the Futtermans down and then they show up in the sequel. So I'm like, okay, they're not dead. And then I actually read something. Because there's a reporter at the end, like on the news, and he's actually a character from The Howling. He appeared in The Howling as well. And he mentions the Futtermans being alive.
Does he really?
Yeah. And man, I never would have got that.
They just really messed everybody up. The police just have like third degree burns. Everyone survives. I don't know.
Except the science teacher.
The science teacher is 100% dead.
Yeah.
And in classic 80s horror fashion, the black guy is the first one to die.
Yeah.
And apparently the only one.
He could just be knocked down.
Mrs. Deagle's got to be dead. Like, there's no way she was launched through her window and survived.
Unless this is all of the characters in this movie are like Hub, and they're just giving the thumbs up at the end on the stretcher.
That's right.
Yes. That's what it is.
I thought you were dead. I'm good.
Yep.
I'm here. So good.
Meanwhile, Billy's love interest, Kate, is busy playing bartender to a rowdy group of gremlins at the local pub. And Billy shows up, they manage to escape, and they take refuge in the bank that they both work at. Kate shares that this is just another reason for her to hate Christmas.
Before we launch into, I've heard some weird things about this bar scene.
Okay.
Besides the ones you just saw? The weird things?
Like, there's like been papers... Academic papers written on this that believe that this whole bar scene represents white fear of black youth in urban environments.
I
specifically because they there's a couple of like Run DMC gremlins.
Yeah. Yep.
I don't know that I buy it. I feel like it's just all pop culture references.
Yeah,
like this whole,
I think so
the whole
too.
Joke in this movie and the sequel is like the pop culture references. So
yeah.
I think you can make an argument about the inclusion of rap and young black characters in 80s movies as representing that. Like, you know, I could see that, but I don't know that I buy that argument for the Gremlins.
The way that I read it is that gremlins, right? No race, no gender. Everyone's just representative of an archetype or personality, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so anyone could read that any way that they choose, obviously, based on research and background and knowledge. But I'm more in agreement with you there because of that fact, because of no gender, no race, etc., with the way, with sort of how the gremlins are represented, that it's more of pop culture references.
Yeah, because there's lots of other ones like throughout, like we've got like It's a Wonderful Life is in there. Like I find it hard to believe that the Mrs. Deagle isn't supposed to be like kind of a nod to the Wicked Witch of the West. There's like, you know, Billy's room is filled with like all kinds of like pop culture things. This boy's life is playing on the movie theater. Like it just like it's packed with pop culture references. And in 1984, rap and like break dancing and all like that would have been part of the pop culture lexicon. So
I think especially in New York and like whatever, if this is set outside of the New York metro area,
mm-hmm.
that would have been especially true.
I do. Yeah. It does slow way down to give us an extended flash dance sequence.
Yeah.
Which would have felt more in place with Gremlins 2 to me, and just kind of like was a little more awkward in this one. I also saw Mrs. Deagle as more of like a Mr. Potter from It's a Wonderful Life, as buying up the town and just malicious intent.
She's just a horrible person. She is awful.
Oh, like, all
and
around.
Her
yes.
Cats are all named after different types of currency. Like, it-
she's very focused.
Very, very. Yes, very. Kate shares why she hates Christmas. And we'll talk about this in greater depth once we're finished the plot synopsis. But when she was 9, we learned her father disappeared on Christmas Eve and he wasn't found for several days. When he was found, he was dressed as Santa Claus and had died in their chimney after he slipped and broke his neck.
Yeah, I had to fast forward through this part when I was watching with the
kids. I was going to say, is this the part that you- Yeah.
I was like, I'm going to show you guys this movie. And
that's then how I found out there was no Santa Claus. That's what she says.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. Yeah.
I fast forwarded through it and like I didn't want them to, they're not there yet, you know? And so they're like, okay, what happened? I'm like, oh, it's just a big boring speech about her dad being dead. So I have no problem traumatizing the idea of a dead dad. I just, you know,
wonder in Santa Claus. Story. That's fair. That's fair. The gremlins at this point have calmed down and they're watching Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs at the movie theater. So this is a perfect opportunity. They're all together. They can eliminate the gremlin threat and they blow up the theater by basically causing a gas explosion. However, they are not aware that Stripe, the ringleader, had left the theater to get more candy from a store across the street. So when they see him, they follow him further into the department store and Gizmo manages to save the day just as Stripe is about to spawn more gremlins by opening a skylight. Sorry, Stripe is about to spawn more gremlins at a fountain. Gizmo opens the skylight to destroy Spike. Spike, why do I keep calling him Spike? Stripe.
You know, when I was a kid, I called him Spike also, and I don't know
why. Weird. Yeah.
Okay. Being exposed to sunlight is fatal to Mogwai and gremlins alike, and Stripe melts into this nasty pile of bones and goo.
It's such a good... special effects.
It's so good.
Mm-hmm. And then even when it throbs at the end.
Oh, yeah.
Originally, they shot it with Billy also opening a shade. Like, Billy's the one who kills Stripe in the original version of this. And that, but when it comes out, it's just Gizmo responsible. And so Zach Galligan and Joe Dante are talking about this on the commentary. And, you know, Steven Spielberg was heavily involved, obviously, in the movie. And so when Zach Galligan is jokingly being bitter about it, Dante says to him, would you like to take a guess as to whose idea it was, you know, to make it Gizmo? And Zach Galligan said, no, because I'd like to work again for him in the future.
Smart. That is smart. That night, Mr. Wing shows up at the Peltzer home to take Gizmo back, and he lectures the family about their carelessness and says, I can't remember the exact line, but basically about, you know.
With great power comes great responsibility.
Yes, yes.
Right? That's this movie, isn't it?
That's 100%. That's really what it is. And then Gizmo says goodbye to Billy, which is so sad. Which also then kind of, I feel like, softens Mr. Wing a little bit. And he tells Billy that he may be ready one day. And until then, Gizmo will be waiting. And that's the plot of the movie. So let's talk about your favorite scenes.
I think for me, it's got to be the Christmas caroling.
So good.
That was the scene where it crossed a line.
Yes, exactly.
Where you're just like, wait, where did they get pants?
Probably at the same department store that Stripe got the candy from.
Yeah, yeah.
So what about it? Why the Christmas Carol scene, do you think?
I just, like, you know, like Steve said, it's just where the movie goes. Like, so I've been thinking about this a lot lately with movies. I just watched Resurrection, which is that movie with Tim Roth.
Oh, and Rebecca Hall?
Yeah, and I won't spoil it for anybody listening who hasn't seen it, but there's a point that comes in that movie where, to me, the premise was too ridiculous to continue. I was like, sorry, I don't buy it. I can buy a lot of things. I can buy a lot of odd premises in movies, especially horror movies, but that was one where I was like, nope, I don't buy it. And so with Gremlins, like, it's taking you along for this ride, and you're like, okay, there could be this weird creature that we've never seen before. Okay, it can have these arcane rules about water and sunlight and eating after midnight. Okay, I guess that there's biology possible. But then we get to the point where they're standing in front of somebody's house singing songs that they have no reason to ever have learned or know. Like,
and they're holding sheet music.
Yes, I can't read sheet music. How can a gremlin? Where if you have to be bought into it at that point, and just like it's like that part of Splash Mountain where it just goes up and then shoots down, like you have to be along for that downward spiral into absurdity. If you are, then you truly love this movie, and it's a formative one for you, and I think it is for all of us here.
Nice.
I love the kitchen sequence.
Oh.
Where she doesn't hesitate. She takes charge. And she starts microwaving and pureeing gremlins. And she just goes one after another. She doesn't, like, you know, run out of the room waiting for someone to rescue her. She just takes them on. I enjoyed that.
Yeah, like, there's a different version of this movie where she could have been the final mom.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it gets really gross and goopy. And I did not remember it being so gross. Not as bad as it gets when Stripe dies at the end and he turns into like some sort of molded pudding that they crush. But
that,
yeah,
must be where they get the blob reference from for that review.
Mm-hmm.
That
he gave. Yes.
I'm right there with the kitchen, but I gotta say my favorite scene and what always really scared me was the YMCA scene where Stripe, they're chasing him and they're trying to catch him before this horrible thing happens and it's just going to set off chaos in the town. And so he jumps into the pool and they're just looking on in like terrified disbelief as the fog machine goes wild. Yes. And just those horrible noises go off and the lights underneath the water in the pool. It just, like, it's such a good sequence and it leaves a lot to the imagination as well. It's a lot of fun. I don't know how long the cocoon process lasts, though, because they came out of that pool pretty quick.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
I think it's because he was already a gremlin.
Yeah.
Well, it's like when you watch Buffy the Vampire Slayer and it takes this person to turn, like, an hour to turn into a vampire and the other person, they have to, like, be buried and, you know, into the grave.
Well, I think it's because Spike's already a gremlin, so maybe it's just a little more instantaneous. I don't know that they cocoon at all necessarily, but that just shows more of the evolution of the creature. Like, what happens then? From there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I did enjoy as they see the bubbles in the fog and the lights in the pool, the just the look of kind of hopelessness on their faces when they realize what is happening.
I think anytime there is a pool in a horror movie, it usually gets me. Like, I'm like totally absorbed that I'm like, something terrifying is gonna happen here, like at the pool. Like, there's like Let the Right One In with the pool scene.
Yeah. It Follows.
It Follows, The Faculty, like so many great pool scenes in.
Let's make our Letterboxd pool scene list.
Yes.
I think it's an argument that it's a liminal space in the Gothic sense.
They use fog machines very effectively. Like you said, the fog machine in the pool, but also even when they first hatch and they get the fog coming up from like their like cocoons and the green light.
I love the use of fog in the 80s. It's like no one had ever seen a... I don't know when the fog machine was invented, but from Swamp Thing to... Actually, I think Swamp Thing... When was that? Was it 1980, 81?
Might have been somewhere in the late
70s. But like once the fog machine came into play or some version of the fog machine, because I don't know how they were making fog before this, but there's just amazing fog scenes in everything. Like, and then we have a whole movie called The Fog.
That's right. Like,
it's just it's fantastic.
I believe until 1978, they had to actually import fog from a farm. And so it was much more expensive.
So there's two Letterboxd lists right there. Fog movies and pool scenes in horror movies. I love it.
Well, I have a late addition here.
Let's
as
go.
Far as a factoid that just completely boggled my
mind. Oh, yeah.
We were talking about Mrs. Deagle and how she kind of was like Wicked Witch / Mr. Potter. And, you know, I remember her fondly as Flo. Can you guess how old Polly Holiday was when she played this rich elderly lady?
Oh, gosh.
Just take a stab.
I think she was only in like maybe her 50s, early 50s.
Yeah, I'm going to say 52.
46 years
old. Oh my God, she's the same age as me.
Yeah, I was like 50 maybe, but I can see it. They really packed a lot of makeup and stuff on her.
Plus, like there's just that thing where people used to look older.
Yes.
Like
true.
Like this goes back to
was I she love a Lucy, smoker? You know? Do we that the actress
by was chance? She a smoker? I mean, I feel like everybody smoked back then. I just wonder because,
you know, a time period when a lot of people would smoke, and I think it prematurely ages you quite a bit, so.
That's why all the fog.
That's where the fog came from. The Marlboro Lights.
Yes.
Or if it's my grandmother, Newports, I think the minty flavored ones.
I'm a huge fan of the show The Golden Girls. Like, I love it. It's what I go to sleep to every night. My partner can recite every line from the show now because of how often I watch it. And I'm always shocked because they're always in like they start in their early 50s, and I'm like, but they look like they're 60 or 70 years old. They can't be that close in age to me now.
As a kid, they were impossible.
Yes, old. Exactly, exactly.
Well, look at like Cheers, you know, like Norm. And,
yeah.
It's amazing though. Cause when I think about when I saw my first horror film and I was 5 years old, my grandmother, she passed away at the age of 76 and I was 23. So like when I was five, how old were you? I guess she was in her 60s maybe. But even then she looked 80 years old, like, or older than that. But it was because she smoked back. What is it? She was a chain smoker and she had a bottle of Canadian Mist hidden under her bed. Like, I love my grandmother. Like, my grandmother's my favorite person, but there's a lot of little funny anecdotes about her that explain why people look prematurely old.
So my favorite scene, or one of my favorite scenes, is when the new Mogwai hatch. From like the time the water hits Gizmo to the moment that they unfurl themselves. Because like poor Gizmo, like that looks like so painful. These like bubbles just kind of popping up in his back, and then they just start shooting off of him, and then they slowly unfurl their big ears from away from their faces, and Gizmo just looks distraught. He's like, this is bad news. And you know, Stripe chomps on Pete's finger, and Pete's reaction, it's just this whole perfect moment and this perfect reveal of this is what happens when water hits one of these creatures. Like, I just love it.
How many times do you think Gizmo has been through this? Like, I don't know how old Gizmo is. You know, maybe he's like the Golden Girls and he looks a lot older than he actually is. But like, do you think that there have been other times, other occurrences? Are there other little small towns that have been laid waste by gremlins?
So here's Roanoke. The thing. Brand talks about yes. that at the end of the film. He gives a warning.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, his voiceover at the end.
Oh, yeah. I forgot there was a weird voiceover.
Yes.
From the guy who was out of town the entire time.
That's right.
He's like the cowboy in The Big Lebowski, the framing device.
Yeah, so anytime, like, a city has disappeared, like, that's probably what happened. Atlantis, Roanoke, those are the only ones I can think of.
Atlantis.
Hey.
You can't bring a Mogwai to an island. That's just spells disaster.
Well, look what happened.
Yes.
All right. So what is the best scare for you?
What I always found the most creepy was them discovering the science teachers, we don't know now, I guess, incapacitated or body, you know, like that syringe sticking out of his butt. Like, to me, that was always the creepiest part of the movie.
Yeah, that's actually mine. I have two. So it would be that one and just how it's like, it's so perfectly paced as well. I'll save the other one though.
Maybe it's when Mrs. Deagle confronts him at the bank. Threatens his dog.
I mean, she's horrible. Like, the way she leans in and whispers to him about what she wants to do to his dog.
Bare minimum, if someone threatens your pet, you don't, like, serve them. You make them go to a different teller.
Yeah.
I think the first onset of the true chaos when the cops pull up and the Santa, who's got, like, three gremlins just attached to him by what seems like their mouths. I think for me, at least as a kid, that was the most terrifying. And as an adult, having played Santa at many a family Christmas party, it's an extra thing now I have to worry about.
That's true. You never know when the gremlins are going to show up.
No.
Surprisingly, this film didn't scare me as a kid. So for whatever reason, I don't scare very easy. So a lot of this stuff just fascinated me versus freaking me out. So for me, there's just, like, the kitchen stuff was happening and I didn't love all the goo sometimes, but I was like excited by what was happening.
Right. Oh, right.
Sorry about my dog.
That's okay.
Less a scare, but more of a gross out.
Maybe. Yeah, a gross out. And I think probably her speech was actually more affecting for me than anything else. And then also there's a line that I didn't understand when I was a kid where Billy talks about how he thought everyone was happy during the holidays. And she says, most people are, but some aren't. While everybody else opens up presents, they're opening up their wrists.
It's so yeah. Dark.
And this is like, what? Is this PG-13? PG?
PG, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it was because of this in Temple of Doom.
These were the jokes for adults, and I was just like, what?
Yeah, can you imagine, like, your 8-year-old turning to you and saying, like, what does that mean, Mom? Like, that's... Oh.
I read a thing where they were saying that... people would take their kids because they didn't show the gremlins. They only showed Gizmo in the commercial. And so Gizmo's cute and they're like, oh, he's like fluffy and he looks like a stuffed animal. And they had this huge marketing campaign and there were toys. So people thought, it's a kid's movie. I'm going to take my 4-year-old to see Gremlin. And then Santa is ruined for them. And
does it say anything about, yes, one, they're going to find out that Santa doesn't exist. And two, was there any reports at all? I don't know if you did any kind of like news search on Gremlins from the time period or if there'd even be an archive, but I'm curious, like, how many families and children like ran out of the theater?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. I didn't find anything. I did look, but I couldn't find anything. I'm sure, you know, curious. If I had done a more intense,
I feel like it probably happened somewhere.
Oh yeah.
I think there's always been Ohio. A history of like family complaints about TV and movies. And I think that just there's too much money being made for anybody in power to care, you mm-hmm. know, for better or worse. Like I think they, will allow that, those couple of eggs to be broken.
Yeah.
Or in the sequel, you'll just make fun of parents complaining about their kid being scared by bringing them out to a movie theater manager.
For me, the other one is Mrs. Peltzer going up to the attic. Also, they have this huge home. Why is Billy's room in the attic? I don't understand.
It's like the Greg Brady thing. It's just cooler.
That's
I wanted an attic bedroom.
That the way that they're situated, and this is... my house actually is really similar to their house. There's the big living room area when you first enter. There's the bedrooms off to the side. And the rooms are quite small. And Billy's older now, I guess. Mm. And the attic has been converted into a bonus room. So
yeah.
That would be – it's the biggest potential bedroom in the house. Perfect for a teen boy – like right? So that can be, that's my assumption, is that they, the house probably looks a little bit bigger than it is.
But when she, so when Mrs. Peltzer goes up to the attic, she's got her knife in her hand because she hears something, and she gets the call from Billy and learns that the gremlins have hatched just as their call disconnects. And then "Do You Hear What I Hear" starts playing.
That was such an amazing moment. I love that so much.
That's one of the best things about that whole scene, is it starts that when you turn classic holiday songs into horrifying, like,
yes,
I love when songs that were initially sweet or something get set to a horrifying scene. Super exciting for me. And Barbarian's a great example.
Yeah,
Be My Little Baby.
Yeah, and it just, it, it's such a good needle drop that you forget that, oh, the gremlin knows how to work a record player.
They're very intelligent. I think that's the scariest thing about this film.
They can sing along to Snow White, having never seen it before.
They love Snow White.
Yeah.
Why do they love Snow White?
I was wondering how they got the rights to Snow White to include in this. I don't think
they did. Like, maybe retroactively. But
I don't know.
It would depend.
This was during Disney's dark days financially, so maybe it's just, you know, they offered him just enough money.
Not very much. That's where most of the $11 million budget went.
Exactly.
But there's, I mean, the practical effects, too, in the film are one of the things that really sells it for me. There's, like you said, great pacing, really cool effects, costuming, the whole gambit, perfectly timed soundtrack.
The soundtrack is so good. Like, the Gremlins rag is, like, it's perfection to me.
Yeah. Doesn't that kick in full force first when they're, like, when they start driving the snowplow?
Gremlins Mega Madness. It's so good. It's 4 minutes long, and that, I think that's how long the whole sequence. Well, Gremlins, the Gremlin rag is also 4 minutes long. And Gremlins Mega Madness, I think, is when the first bit of chaos starts. Yeah, it's so, so good.
Very different from what, like, I always, the other soundtrack that I always associate with Jerry Goldsmith, Alien.
Right. Alien and Poltergeist.
That's right. Yes. Yeah. Did he do with The Omen as well?
You know, I have to double check. I haven't covered that one on Slay Away yet, but that The Omen was actually one of my favorite horror films for a very, very long time. It was at the top of my list.
Yep. Jerry Goldsmith with music in The Omen.
I talked to a friend who is a movie score geek. She just nerds out on him all the time. And I asked her about Jerry Goldsmith, and she just kind of like went, he just had the unfortunate timing to be a contemporary of John Williams. Otherwise, we'd talk about him a lot more.
Maybe it's just me. I guess I feel like I talk about him a lot because of horror films, even though I know he's done a lot of non-horror films. I mean, he did all the scores for the Star Trek movies. Like,
all right. Any random thoughts? Anything else that we haven't covered that you wanted to talk about?
There was a little Easter egg early on when they walked by the movie theater. This is also a movie. That's so true. There's those two things.
That's true.
The joke was so much funnier in my head. I'm sorry.
I was right with you, man. I promise I was right with you.
See, this... Oh, my God. Do you do body count, don't you, Sherry?
I do, yes.
Because there's a body count trivia right here saying what the people died in this film. It's okay. Sequels always resurrect everyone.
It's true. That's true. It's a very good point.
So, so we were talking about how the mom's head comes off originally.
Yeah.
Apparently, the science teacher originally gets all the hypodermic needles to the face. And so he would have definitely been more definitively dead.
One thing that I liked, I read a Twitter thread and by somebody named Jacob de Noel, and he talked about each act basically serving as its own completely different genre, and yet the movie still manages to work. So act one is like a small town Christmas film, and even, like, you know, you see Billy and Barney running down the street, and it's like this nice little snowy main street, small town they're running through. And then you have act two, which is a very Spielbergian story about a boy and his weird little pet. Then you have act three, which is full on horror and all the chaos. Act four is broad comedy, where you get your Gremlins singing, I guess. And Act Five is just a thriller, like with like the kind of the showdown at the end. And I was like, that actually really, like, it's very true. And the fact that Joe Dante makes that work is incredible to me.
He's so good at the horror comedy balance. He would do The Burbs some years later, which is just another one that straddles that line so well. I am so impressed by this. This movie is totally, not to make a Gremlins 2 reference, but lightning in a bottle. Like, it's just like all these players, all these performers, all these creators just at the top of their game who got put together, and it's supposed to be, you know, like we said, a little B movie that suddenly just became so much more. And I think that's why it sticks with us all these years later. It just, right place, right time, right people, right puppets, I guess, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, that's another thing I wanted to bring up.
Yeah.
The original plan, and if you're a fan of Jordan Peele's Nope, then this will especially ring funny to you. They originally were going to use monkeys instead of puppets. And
oh, no.
Opted against it because the first time they tried to put a gremlin costume on the monkey freaked out.
Oh no, that's terrible.
Yeah.
Thank goodness it didn't work out.
It did not become a Gordy situation.
No. Because the puppets are like so perfect. Like there's that scene where they're like, I think Gizmo's playing the little trumpet and then the other ones are gathered around like a little, one of those old video game things.
Oh, the little Donkey Kong.
Yeah, thing. Yeah, and they're like, yeah. And like they're bouncing all over the place, and it's just so, it's so well done. The puppets are perfect, and apparently they were so concerned about somebody stealing the puppets that the actors and crew had to get their like stuff checked before they left the set to like make sure that nobody was taking any Gremlin puppets with them.
I will say, Billy is watching Invasion of the Body Snatchers from 1956, another one of my favorite films, in his room, and it's about aliens that take over a whole city, just like the Gremlins. So it's super fun, and I love, there's a, like you said, it's just another of those references.
He's even watching it at the part where they're coming out of the pods.
Mm-hmm. The little seed pods.
Yeah.
Maybe that's another reason it works so well, because I mean, not only do you have folks who are good at their craft, but this is made by people who have a love for the genre and a love for cinema in general. You know, a friend of mine was talking about, we were having a disagreement about Terrifier, and he was able to concede that while he didn't like Terrifier, he didn't see it as soulless. He knew that it was created with love, created by somebody who has a love for cinema and the genre. And there are so many movies, like all of the ripoffs that came after this. I wouldn't say that those are all good. You know, I wouldn't say they were all made with soul. They were made to make money.
Yeah.
They even grabbed the editor of this film to direct Munchies. And,
oh,
we have Ghoulies, we have Critters. We have
Critters is one of those that I think was made with soul and with talent.
Yes.
But that's just not true. And this movie, for whatever Leonard Maltin had to say about it at the time, this was made with a lot of love for the medium and for the genre. And it's, you have to dig to find those references. Like you have to know those references. But I think that kind of proves that it was made with that.
Yeah.
The two things I remember from when I was a kid was the staircase, the electric staircase, because
yes.
It just seemed, I'd never seen like the electric chair, not electric chair, but you know what I mean? The mobile chair that goes up the staircase. And I always remember that, her flying out of the window. And then just the madcap bar scene and how she keeps pouring drinks. And I was like, well, just leave. How does she know what drink they want?
She is of the darkness. She lives in the darkness.
She does. That's true.
Thrives there. That's why the Gremlins accept her as one of their own.
I did not know this, but I guess that the chainsaw scene at the end, Joe Dante added it in as an homage to the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. It wasn't originally in the script.
Really?
The hardware store? Yeah.
I love that.
So I was like, that's great. I always like the motion that happens with the chainsaw, like I always kind of would visualize the Texas Chainsaw Massacre in my head. Of course, I saw that many years later, but it's interesting to know that that's actually what it was. And it's funny because I'm reading the town itself always makes me think of Back to the Future.
And it was actually, mm-hmm. I think it was used in Back to the Future.
Yeah, it is. Okay, yeah. So I was like, why does this look like, what is it, Hill Valley, Twin Pines,
yeah.
Mall area?
Yeah, this is the same movie theater that the DeLorean crashes into.
Right, okay, yes. I was like, it's so funny when we have that overhead shot of the town. I was like, oh, well, it's Hill Valley. So
the main thing I noticed on this viewing of the town is that the trees all have leaves. And those leaves have fake snow on them.
It's kind of like in Halloween where like the leaves are all green, but yet they're falling.
Yeah.
Yeah. So body count, we don't know. We're not sure. I would have originally said we had four because we had Mr. Hansen, Mrs. Deagle, and the Futtermans, but the Futtermans show up in two. So I'm going to assume they're not dead.
I'm going to look at something because I have one instance where it says five, and there is, let's see.
I mean, there are characters that just disappear, like Judge Reinhold and the bank manager.
That's right. It's true. Yeah. Judge Reinhold. Look at me. I'm poised to be the next vice president. I'm 23 years old.
And you look 33. Yes.
Well, it won't take me to the page that I want to look at. I'm like, show me the kills. But IMDb says it's five.
Okay, we're going to go with five. I like it.
Because
like
we have two police officers, Mrs. Deagle and the Futtermans. That's five.
I have to count Gremlins 2 as canon and say...
Well, yeah, we can now, but then I still say there's three deaths in this movie.
How many scaredy cat screams, 1 through 5, would you rate Gremlins?
5 out of 5. Classic.
I think I gave it on Letterboxd. I think I gave it 4.5 because to me, it just did drag a tiny bit. Like we watched a Flashdance tribute that just lasted a little
long. Come on. There's no such thing as a Flashdance tribute lasting too long.
And I think if that was in Gremlins 2, that would, you know, Gremlins 2, which is the epitome of Joe Dante's id, apparently, that would have fit in better with that. But it just felt like it was almost self-indulgent. Like they would just got around a table and just brainstormed what they could have Gremlins do and just put it all in. But I did love it. I do love it. And I wish Phoebe Cates had been in a lot more stuff.
Mm-hmm. You got Deborah Wingard.
I don't know. She married Kevin Kline and had some kids and, you know, I guess is enjoying her life with him. So
maybe she more Bridget Fonda did.
That's who I was thinking of too.
It's a 4 for me. I still love this film. I absolutely adore it, but I'm not going to say on all levels that it's, like the way that I think of critiquing is like I look at the score, I look at the cinematography, I look at the performances, the acting, but there are some goofs and little things, but it's one of those films that you still love it. So but from a technical and everything altogether perspective, I would say it's
Steve pointed out to me on Tuesday that I don't rate movies on Letterboxd, and I also don't do it in my own podcast. So, but this one I will. I would give it a five. It's definitely a movie that I have a lot of nostalgia for, and it just makes me feel happy and festive. And I had the opportunity on Friday to see it on the big screen in 35mm, and it was so cool. It's probably one of my favorite movie going experiences, despite the fact that one of my friends fell asleep next to me. And she'd never seen it.
We can't all know everything about 80s pop culture and be entertained.
It's true. It's very true. Awesome. Well, thank you for coming on to talk about Gremlins today. Now's your opportunity to plug your social media. Tell us where listeners can find you.
I'll start. It's the show is called Video of the Damned, and videoofthedamned.com will lead you to the YouTube, although I think YouTube now has custom URLs, so it might be just also youtube.com/videoofthedamned. On Twitter, it's Video Damned, and on Instagram, it's Video of the Damned, but you can find me at Hub Unofficial. So hubunofficial.com or on Twitter at Hub Unofficial, and that will lead you to everywhere else to see all the silly things I'm saying and am up to.
Let's see. For me, you can find most of what I'm doing on Slayaway. A lot of my time is spent on content editing and film criticism. I write a lot of reviews. So you can find me mostly on Film Cred as well. And so, you know, filmcred.com, slayawaywithus.com. And then for me personally, it's just Enola Lugosi is my tag everywhere.
Awesome. And you can find your podcasts on all the major podcasts.
You can. Right? I'm remastering the old episodes right now. So, like, don't judge them too harshly. Once I found out that the guy from Lore remastered all his early episodes, I was like, it's cool. I can do it too.
Absolutely.
But that would entail listening to your early episodes. And I don't want to listen to my early episodes.
Oh, I don't mind. They're really fun to revisit. My episodes are amazing. There you go. I had to, you open the door for me to plug it.
Of course. Absolutely.
I do think they're all really fun. And Sherry and I do some similar stuff, but then mine also has its own flair. So, and I love that about the fact mm-hmm. that we could both be covering this film this week, but we're going to have vastly different episodes.
I know there's so many horror podcasts, and like a little while ago, I was like, hey, I should just stop doing this. Like there's like, you know, there's so many horror podcasts and we all cover like very similar movies. But then I thought, no, like everybody's is different and I enjoy doing it, even if it's just because I enjoy talking to other horror fans for, you know, 1 to 2 hours about a movie. So
yeah, I have a Doctor Who podcast and there are an abundance of those. So yeah, I know what you mean.
Fantastic. But yours is the first one I know about. So
well, there you go.
Now I can go listen to yours first.
Yeah, mine is Drunkter Who, which we should have thought better how to spell that. But it's basically if you search those things for drunk Doctor Who, we drink a couple beers and talk Doctor Who. I'm watching it for the first time. We're about to start Jodie Whittaker's second season. So we're kind of catching up.
I'm a big fan of the Matt Smith years, so I want to go listen to all those episodes, like maybe as a commentary after I rewatch the episode. Oh, yeah. That sounds like a perfect time for me.
Yeah. Yeah. There's plenty of time before there are new Doctor Who episodes. Maybe
I'll just turn it on and then turn. Is it you talk about the episode, but you don't do it like an audio commentary, do you?
No. What happens because I've never watched it before. But I've never watched it before. So we basically do a little intro and part of that intro is my co-host John just telling me the title and making me predict what's going to happen.
Fantastic.
I've been right maybe once.
It's kind of hard to tell what's going to happen.
Yeah. And so, yeah, then we like talk about it and we enjoy it. It's fun.
So I'm going to ask you, Steve, what is your favorite? Because Doctor Who is famous for their Christmas episodes. Do you have a favorite Christmas episode?
They're all kind of unique and they're all a little goofy. Because there was the one with a flying shark and Michael Gambon. I did enjoy, I enjoyed the first one I saw, which was, I don't remember the name, but it was where David Tennant, where his first appearance as the Doctor.
Mm-hmm.
That might have been my favorite. I'm trying to remember now. Oh. There was one where they basically went to Narnia. I don't remember the titles. Because I've seen them all once.
Right.
They went to essentially Narnia, and that was kind of, that was a fun one. Do you have a favorite? See, it's not so easy.
It's not so easy. No. I just love Doctor Who. So, I don't know. I should actually do a little marathon of them this weekend while I'm baking, and just watch the Christmas episodes. Maybe I'll do that, and then I'll get back to you and let you know.
Ooh, that's a good question. Like, if you're watching Gremlins, which holiday cookie are you eating? That's what I want to know.
Well, they make some really janky gingerbread cookies in these, poorly frosted, it looked like.
You know what's funny? I, as part of a work team building exercise today, and we're a remote first company, over Zoom we were doing a gingerbread cookie decorating contest. I was not good at it.
It's surprisingly more difficult to spread and mm-hmm. like artfully use frosting. I think part of it is because it can get very melty.
Yes.
You have to start with a very like firm base, but then it's hard to make it move around.
My wife starts planning out her Christmas cookies in August, and she's got a spreadsheet. And she makes probably like 8 different kinds every year.
Can you ship some up to Canada?
Yeah. Like
the ones she finished just the other day were gingerbread cheesecake bars.
Oh my gosh. Those were very good.
Yeah, like, can you send us some?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sure they'd travel well, especially with dairy involved.
Oh, it'd be well, fine. It depends on how far apart we are.
That's true.
I'm in Tennessee. You can ship them to the Nashville area.
Oh, I'm in Chicago, so, you know.
You're only 6 hours away.
There you
ship
go.
Ship them on down. They'll be fine.
I'll meet you in Indianapolis.
Okay, deal.
Yeah, I'm also SRDAHLIN, SR Dahlin, on pretty much all the social media nonsense. That's what I use. Twitter, I don't know how long I'm going to, I don't know. Twitter's complicated right now, so I've signed up for a few other things.
We're all going to get suspended from Twitter at the rate that yes.
Yeah.
I was watching Gremlins on Sunday, and I was eating peppermint brownies that I had made. So that's instead of a cookie, I would eat some kind of bar like that. Although I love cookies too, but that's just what I was eating.
What my grandmother did during the holidays was fudge. So that's like the thing that
we'll nice. Make.
But it's like the condensed milk, like yes. the traditional old school carnation condensed milk fudge.
Oh, that sounds so good.
And with peppermint, like bark type stuff, that sounds
peppermint bark.
Now I'm just like hungry. And I would like some chocolate.
Same. I have some brownies left over. I might have one when we finish. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming on and talking about Gremlins with us. You can catch us on Twitter at @CatScaredy and on Instagram at @ScaredyCats the podcast. I do have a Hive account, but I think it's just @ScaredyCats the podcast. And yeah, subscribe wherever you find podcasts. Don't forget to let us know what you think by leaving us a review. Until next time, stay scared.